From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Well, as we enter a new hurricane season, we're turning natural disasters into human catastrophes by our failure to deal with issues like climate, like loss of wetlands and coastal sprawl. I think we know what the solutions are, but we're going to need a seaweed rebellion, a marine grassroots movement, really to turn things around.
Environmental author David Helvarg on hurricanes, coastal development, and Category 5 foolishness. Then we'll speak with Salma Yaqub. She's in from Britain, the first Muslim woman wearing a hijab elected to the city council in Birmingham. And she's head of the Stop the War coalition there.
Well, we're now into the third year of this war, and we've had a lot of talk about democracy in the Middle East, but I think we really need a debate about democracy in America and in Britain. How is it that our governments can take our countries to war against the wishes of the majority of the people? And as a British Muslim, I think we have an important contribution to make in that debate.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Pentagon has decided to make it official policy to ignore a key tenet of the Geneva Convention that explicitly bans humiliating and degrading treatment of detainees. According to the paper, the Pentagon's new Army Field Manual on Interrogation marks a further and potentially permanent shift away from strict adherence to international human rights standards. For decades, it's been the official policy of the U.S. military to follow the minimum standards for treating all detainees as laid out in the Geneva Convention. But in 2002, Bush suspended portions of the convention for accused members of al-Qaeda and Taliban. Critics said the Pentagon's latest decision would violate a broadly supported anti-torture measure advanced by Senator John McCain to ban torture and cruel treatment. The Los Angeles Times reports the move to officially ignore parts of the Geneva Convention was supported by Vice President Dick Cheney's office and by the Pentagon's intelligence arm. Sources said Cheney's Chief of Staff David Addington and Stephen Cambone, the Defense Undersecretary for Intelligence, claim the Geneva Conventions restrict the United States' ability to question detainees. The Pentagon's decision to officially ignore parts of the Geneva Conventions comes at a time that the military's actions in Iraq are coming under increasing scrutiny. Over the weekend, top officials in Iraq demanded the U.S. do more to investigate two different alleged massacres at the hands of U.S. troops, the killing of 24 civilians in Haditha last November and the killing of 13 in the town of Ashaki outside Balad in March. On Saturday, Major General William Caldwell announced the Pentagon had cleared U.S. troops of any wrongdoing in the killings in Ashaki.
In response to claims that as many as 13 civilians were killed in a March 15th airstrike in the vicinity of Ashaki, an investigation was launched into that incident the very next day. The investigation revealed the ground force commander, while capturing and killing terrorists at that location, operated in accordance with the rules of engagement governing our combat forces in Iraq.
However, the Iraqi government has rejected the Pentagon's findings. On Saturday, an aide to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said the Iraqi government would open its own investigation into the deaths of Iraqi civilians in Ashaki. The Iraqi human rights minister said a commission will be sent to the town to investigate the deaths in the next few days. Relatives of the Iraqi family killed in Ashaki accused the U.S. of slaughtering innocent civilians. This is Ibrahim Arad Khalaf.
The U.S. forces raided my brother's house on March 15th. They started shooting into the air before entering the house. This process lasted for about 20 minutes, and after that, they entered the house and started shooting inside it. They gathered all of the family members inside one room and executed all of them.
Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has defended the training and conduct of U.S. troops and said incidents such as the massacre of Iraqi civilians at Haditha are anomalies.
We know that 99.9% of our forces conduct themselves in an exemplary manner. And we also know that in conflicts, things that shouldn't happen do happen.
However, the wife of one of the staff sergeants involved in the Haditha killings has told Newsweek that there was a total breakdown in discipline, including drug and alcohol abuse, within the Marine unit. She said, quote, "I think it's more than possible that these guys were totally tweaked out on speed or something when they shot those civilians in Haditha." The Los Angeles Times is reporting government records show that more Baghdad residents died in shootings, stabbings and other violence in May than in any other month since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Just under 1,400 bodies were brought to the city's central morgue during the month. The actual number of people killed in Baghdad was even higher because the count doesn't include soldiers or civilian victims of explosions. This past weekend saw another surge in violent killings. North of Baghdad, masked gunmen assassinated 21 students, reportedly all Shia, who were stopped at a fake checkpoint. In Basra, a suicide car bomber killed 32 people and wounded 77. The attack came just days after the Iraqi government declared a state of emergency in the southern city. In Baghdad, officials discovered 22 bodies that had been burned, blindfolded, handcuffed and thrown into a river. Earlier today, gunmen wearing police uniforms raided bus stations in central Baghdad, abducting at least 50 people. Meanwhile, the new Iraqi government has failed once again in agreeing to who will head key security ministries. And in other news from Iraq, an Iraqi man has been jailed for life after being found guilty of involvement in the kidnapping and murder of aid worker Margaret Hassan. In Peru, Alan Garcia has defeated Ollanta Humala to become Peru's next president. Garcia served as president from 1985 to 1990. He won about 55% of the vote. In 1990, Garcia left office in disgrace, with Peru nearly bankrupt. His administration was widely accused of corruption. On Sunday, Garcia claimed his victory was a blow to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who'd publicly supported Humala's candidacy. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales has introduced a sweeping new land reform program to give farmland to poor indigenous communities. On Saturday, he handed over 10,000 square miles of state-owned property. More land, including unused private property, is expected to be turned over as part of what Morales called an agrarian revolution. Morales has defended the plan despite protests from the business community.
Some businessmen are trying to subdue us, but I ask myself, they, their grandparents, have subjugated our lands for more than 500 years, and these lands have to return to the hand of the absolute owners of this noble land. Who are the Quechuas, the Aymaras, Mojenos, Chipayas, Chiquitanos?
In Canada, 12 men and 5 youths have been rounded up in what's been described as one of the largest anti-terrorism operations ever undertaken in North America. More than 400 police officers took part in a series of raids Saturday. The men have been accused of planning to carry out attacks in southern Ontario with bombs made from the fertilizer ammonium nitrate. It's unclear how much of the plot was actually a government sting operation. According to the Toronto Star, it was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police itself that delivered 3 tons of the potential bomb-making material to the group. Once the material was delivered, officials moved in and made the arrests of the men and teens. A major United Nations conference on AIDS called on the international community to raise as much as $23 billion a year in order to be able to ensure universal access to prevention, treatment and care by 2010. The summit's final declaration called on countries to commit to a wide range of prevention strategies, including abstinence, fidelity, condom use and clean needles. While the United Nations declared the summit a success, a group of AIDS organizations criticized the international body for not doing enough. The group Action Aid International said in a statement, quote, "We are furious. Vulnerable groups such as intravenous drug users, sex workers, and men who have sex with men have been made invisible in this document." Meanwhile, it was 25 years ago today, June 5, 1981, when a California doctor named Michael Gottlieb published a brief report about the first diagnosis of the HIV virus. Since then, 25 million people have died of AIDS. An average of 8,000 continue to die each day. This is Dr. Michael Gottlieb.
In the first few years after I reported my cases of AIDS, I felt like the people on the rooftops during Katrina, waving, shouting, screaming, begging for help. And it didn't come. And when it came, eventually, it came with all these strings attached. You must have abstinence instead of condoms. You don't get enough medication to treat the people you need to treat who are indigent. Our government has had a colossal failure in responding to the AIDS epidemic.
Dr. Michael Gottlieb. There has been a major development in the case of Wenho Li, the U.S. nuclear scientist of Chinese descent who was falsely accused by the Clinton administration for spying for the Chinese government. The government has agreed to pay Li nearly $900,000 for violating his right to privacy by leaking information to the press. In addition, five major news organizations have agreed to pay Wenho Li $750,000 to settle a lawsuit in order to avoid identifying who within the government leaked information that falsely implicated Wenho Li. When the case first broke, the press used anonymous sources to portray the case as one of the most serious spy scandals in U.S. history. In April 1999, the New York Times opened an article about Wenho Li like this, quote, "A scientist suspected of spying for China improperly transferred huge amounts of secret data from a computer system at a government laboratory, compromising virtually every nuclear weapon in the United States arsenal," government and lab officials say, unquote. 8 months later, Wenho Li was indicted on 59 counts, but none of them were for spying. He was held in solitary confinement and threatened with execution. But within a year, the U.S. government dropped 58 of 59 charges. After Wenho Li had endured 278 days of solitary confinement, a federal judge named James Parker released him from the New Mexico prison. And in an unusual statement from the bench, the judge rebuked the government and apologized to Wenho Li. In news from Washington, President Bush is urging Congress to approve a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. The move comes nearly exactly 6 months before the midterm elections. On Saturday, Bush dedicated his entire weekly radio address to the issue. He never mentioned the war in Iraq once. The Senate is expected to begin debate on same-sex marriage this week. Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist recently argued that banning gay marriage and flag burning are two of the nation's most pressing priorities. Simultaneous protests were held Saturday in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv and the Palestinian city of Ramallah, calling for an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza that began 39 years ago. In Ramallah, demonstrators called for an end to the blockade on the Palestinian people. The Tel Aviv protest was organized by a series of Jewish peace and student groups. This is an Israeli student organizer named Rami.
Yes, we have a similar sister demonstration in Ramallah right now going on, with thousands of people marching there with the same message of peace, that we can cooperate, we can work together, we can destroy the occupation together, destroy the racism, and do something together.
In media news, the leading journalists union in Britain and Ireland have called on their 40,000 members to boycott the internet company Yahoo. The union criticized the company for helping the Chinese government identify and prosecute pro-democracy journalists and dissidents. The union said it would stop using all Yahoo-operated services, including the popular search engine. The American Bar Association Board of Governors has voted unanimously to investigate whether President Bush is violating the Constitution by signing statements to bypass new laws. The Boston Globe recently said President Bush has quietly claimed the authority to disobey an unprecedented 750 laws enacted since he took office. Among other laws, Bush has said he can ignore Congress's ban on torture, as well as the congressional oversight of the Patriot Act. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last Thursday marked the official start of hurricane season. Experts predict there will be 17 storms, resulting in 9 full-blown hurricanes this year. And some point to global warming as a cause for the bigger and stronger storms, like Hurricane Katrina, which devastated the Gulf Coast last year. The United Nations International Panel on Climate Change estimates that temperatures will rise by 10 degrees by the next century. The organization also predicts that rainfall will increase 20% in wet regions, causing floods, and decrease 20% in dry regions, causing droughts. Yet many fear the U.S. is as unprepared as ever to address these potential disasters, even after the experience results of Hurricane Katrina. They point out that government has done little to stop the destruction of wetlands or development along coastal areas, which are factors that transform storms into major human catastrophes. The environmental journalist and author David Helvarg wrote in last week's Los Angeles Times that, quote, "The facts are simple. The best available science tells us we're faced with a projected sea level rise and an increase in Category 4 and 5 hurricanes. We need a pragmatic approach to a changed reality," he wrote, and went on to say, "Those who think they can rebuild in harm's way using the same assumptions that worked in the last century, or who believe they can manage nature by stockpiling generators and water bottles, are living in a dangerous fantasy. Unfortunately, theirs is a fantasy we are having to pay for." These are the words of David Helvarg, who joins us in the studio now. David Helvarg is president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of the books The War Against the Greens and Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness. He has also written 50 Ways to Save the Ocean as a contributor to Feeling the Heat, reports from the front lines of climate change. We welcome you to Democracy
Now.
Thank you,
Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Hurricane season has begun. What does it mean?
Well, it means that we're facing another series of disasters like last year, where we saw a million environmental refugees created in this nation. Half of them are still displaced. And as I said, the hurricanes are natural phenomena, but they're being unnaturally intensified by our failed policies, certainly around climate and fossil fuel-fired climate disruption, the impact that has in terms of intensifying Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, beach erosion, a greater exposure. We're putting more heat in the system, and heat is the driver of hurricanes. We have these 30-year natural cycles of greater and lesser hurricane activity that are linked to a one-degree warming in the North Atlantic. You add another degree of warming since 1970 from fossil fuel-fired climate change, from additional carbon dioxide, and you see tremendous energy. And we saw that last year. We're projecting more and similar storms in the future. And we're not prepared. It's very disturbing what hasn't been done in response to last year's hurricane activity, which is we've thrown tens of billions of dollars at contractors in the Gulf region. We haven't committed dollar, which is to say Congress hasn't committed dollar one to wetlands restoration, even though there's a very practical in-place program called Louisiana 2050, which could restore, for $14 billion, restore the salt marshes and the bayous of southern Louisiana, which act as natural storm barriers. Every 2.5 miles of wetlands reduce a storm surge by a foot. I talked to Mark Davis, who runs Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana. He was shocked. He says he's cynical, but even he expected Congress to begin moving on that. It hasn't. It's practical solutions, as I say. The Gulf Restoration Network, which represents groups of ocean activists, coastal activists, environmentalists, social justice groupings throughout the Gulf region, have issued a report on how these natural barriers could be effective in reducing these impacts. At the same time, Congress approved $23 billion for FEMA to make payments for hurricane claims from last year without doing anything to reform the system. One of the basic proposals is you shouldn't have this insurance unless you're an owner-occupant. A lot of the federal flood insurance is going to second homeowners, to people like where I was at the west end of Dauphin Island. 200 homes blown away, most of them rental units. And 50 of those people were already collecting insurance, our tax money, essentially, from the previous year's hurricane. A $1 million berm, sand berm, that had been built there was blown away. We could just go down the beach with baskets full of $20 bills, throwing them in the water and be more effective.
David Helvarg, how do you restore the wetlands?
The flow from the Mississippi, you restore the Mississippi to what it once was. There's huge amounts of sediments that come down, and historically they were dispersed and actually built up what became the most productive wetlands in the world, the bayous of southern Louisiana. What happened is the Army Corps of Engineers, doing flood management, basically straightened out the Mississippi, turned it into like a hydraulic speedway, as did the oil industry, which built canals, straight lines all through southern Louisiana to access their facilities. The result is all that sediment that used to build up land just gets driven out into the deep Gulf. And because that sediment is now loaded with heavy petrochemical add-ons, with fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer and chemicals, all that sediment, instead of building land, goes out and grows a second bloom of algae, that then as it decays, it becomes a massive dead zone, sucks all the oxygen out of the Gulf. And so if you put the bends and restore the wetlands and the natural flow of the Mississippi, even with subsidence and sea level rise, there's enough sediment flow that you could regrow the wetlands and bring back some of that diversity. And of course, in growing it out, you'd want to reduce the chemical inputs that we've added to industrial agriculture. You want to have clean sediment to build clean and productive wetlands.
David Hilvarg, we're going to break, come back, and find out what are the major forces working against this. David Hilvarg, author of Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. Stay with us. By Michelle Andeganicello. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to David Hilvarg. The hurricane season has begun. David Hilvarg is president of the Blue Frontier Campaign, has written a number of books, including Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness, and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, also The War Against the Greens. And I was wondering, you know, when you did this groundbreaking book, War Against the Greens, you talked about the crackdown on environmentalists. Last week, Rush Limbaugh was attacking you on air. Do you think that kind of attack prevents the kind of discussion that can lead to the solutions?
Only if you let it. I mean, I think the reality is you look at the environmental backlash of the 1990s, and they call themselves the Wise Use Movement. They were funded and structured by industry.
And who was the Wise Use Movement?
The Wise Use Movement was essentially what you call astroturf, synthetic grassroots activists and militants who opposed environmental regulation, particularly of public lands industries in the West. And by the mid-90s, you saw this breakdown where a lot of them were funneled into the militia movement. Today, you look at the veterans of Wise Use, and it's funny, half of them went on to the militia movement. The other half seemed to be high-ranking administration officials. And they're driving a lot of what's passing for what they call, you know, counter-science, what I call counter-science. I mean, no good science goes unpunished in this administration. So, for example, there were a lot of administration people pushing the idea that climate change wasn't linked to last year's hurricanes. In fact, it reflects their inability or unwillingness to hold two thoughts at once, which is there is this natural 30-year cycle that's been identified of greater and lesser hurricane activity in the Atlantic. At the same time, there's no question among scientists that the global warming of the oceans from fossil fuel-fired climate disruption, from adding carbon dioxide and other industrial gases into the atmosphere is a driver not only of hurricanes, but of coral bleaching, of acidification of the oceans, may even slow down the conveyor belt that drives the Gulf Stream.
And David, how serious is the vacuuming, the government vacuuming of websites referring to global warming, removing the words from reports out of the EPA?
Well, it's we're at a crisis, a global crisis situation, and We need a popular response, but we also need a governmental response. When we've had past global crises like Adolf Hitler or the nuclear balance of terror during the Cold War, we need a government response. Right now, our government's in denial. The best available science is creating some of the worst imaginable scenarios, and we have a government that fails to respond, and we know why. I mean, the U.S., you know, administrations traditionally have been responsive to business, but never to a single industrial sector. We now have a president, his dad, his vice president, his secretary of state are all veterans of the oil industry. And essentially they're, you know, they're protecting the 19th century industry that's causing the problems that we have to deal with. I mean, it was interesting. Bush appointed a U.S. Ocean Commission, which came down very strongly for environmental protection of our seas. They say the ecological collapse of our oceans is a threat to our national security, our economy, and our environment. And yet they're being ignored. I now have, am talking with members of Bush's commission who have, two of them, Admiral Paul Gaffney, who used to run the Office of Naval Research for the U.S. Navy, and Lillian Barone, who ran the Port of New York, New Jersey, both wrote an editorial calling for a seaweed revolution. The idea that we're only going to make the change from the bottom up, we're only going to, you know, see what we need to see in terms of climate and pollution and overfishing, when people understand that all the oceans are a public resource and it belongs to all of us, and that we know what the solutions are. People, a lot of people I talk to, they say, you know, how can we deal with something like climate change or the collapse of marine wildlife? I'm an individual. I have a family to raise. I have a job. The reality is we're having those impacts every day in the way we live our lives. It's just a question of making a conscious choice, being conscious of how our impacts are affecting the oceans and the seas around us, and making the right choices.
What are the effects of climate change that will soon become apparent?
Well, I think we're already in the footprint. We're already seeing intensified hurricanes. We're seeing more droughts and historic flooding in certain areas of the world. In terms of the oceans, 70% of the world's beaches are eroding right now. We're seeing more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes since the 1970s. The oceans are more acidic than they've been in at least 4 million years. And, you know, I've been to Antarctica and places where Bill Fraser, who was the lead scientist when I was down there, was saying when he was a graduate student, his professor told him climate change is real, but you'll never see it in your lifetime. He says in the last 20 years, he's seen the landscape ecology altered, you know, glaciers retreating, animal species changing places, the collapse of the Adelie penguins. And what's happening to the penguins and the polar bears today is going to be part of all of our lives for as far as we can look into the future.
David Helvarg, why do you refer to Category 5 foolishness?
Because we're promoting, you know, we've reached the stage where, you know, you now say nobody talks about the weather, but everybody's doing something about it. Where actually the choices we're making today are impacting the weather around us. And it's foolish not to be precautious. It's foolish not to begin planned retreat from the exposed areas. It's foolish to have federal flood insurance that subsidizes people to move in harm's way, that allows people to build second homes on barrier islands. There's a reason they call them barrier islands. I mean, it doesn't seem to get through to the developers. We should maybe call them death by drowning islands. We know how to do it safely. You know, there are developers I know who've built wisely behind the dunes and above hurricane code, and when the hurricanes come, they survive. And you know, it's a moment. You know, crisis also is opportunity. We can turn things around. You know, 150 years ago, some of the leading wealthiest people in this country would have said, getting rid of whale oil is insane. It's the lubricant of the machine age, and it drives our, you know, it lights our finest homes and cities. Well, we went from whale oil to rock oil. Guess what? The economy expanded. You know, we're at another moment where I've been on the oil rigs. They're very impressive. It's a heroic period of U.S. maritime history, but it's obsolete. It's like being on a whaling ship 150 years ago. We have to move on from oil. We have this great opportunity to develop new technologies, and not just in terms of entrepreneurs and inventors, but in each of our lives, we can find new ways to live. And what's interesting, when you do things that help the sea, like eat more organic or vegetarian food or conserve energy, or, you know, or walk more, bike more instead of relying on personal transportation, cars, the things you do that are going to help us get through the crisis also tend to help your health, help your pocketbook.
What do you think are the single most important measures that should be taken for New Orleans right now?
For New Orleans, they've moved to an evacuation program that's going to take all the people out this time. They've, and I think that's at this point good evacuations essential. I mean, that's it. And they've built the levees back to pre-Katrina levels of protection, but without those 140 miles of wetlands that used to sit between New Orleans and the sea, there's not a lot that can be done. People are moving out to the north side of Lake Pontchartrain, to Jefferson Parish, and people are now prepared for an effective evacuation. Beyond that, we have to start looking at how we're going to live in the exposed hurricane zones.
And of the 50 ways to save the ocean, what would you say are the top five?
Top one is definitely know that you can have an impact. It's going back 70 years to what anthropologist Margaret Mead said. You know, don't question that a small group of dedicated people can change the world. Nothing else ever has. Beyond that, you know, obviously energy choices, conserving energy, our food choices in terms of, you know, what we eat, using less plastic. You know, plastic is this huge threat to our ocean environment. Even oil spills biodegrade. Plastic doesn't. It becomes this fine dust that outweighs phytoplankton in the mid-Pacific JR, 6 pounds to 1. Again, voting the coast, voting, getting engaged as a consumer, as a citizen. We talk about vote for those who vote for the coast. And politicians, you can't completely educate them. They're like trying to educate a shark. They're hardwired to money and votes. And if we don't have the money of the offshore oil industry, the shipping industry, the coastal real estate developers, we have to mobilize what I call that seaweed marine grassroots constituency. People have to, and I think once you start doing a few things, once you start making choices as a consumer in your lifestyle and begin becoming more active as a citizen, it gets kind of addictive. You know, change is good, and before you know it, you got no time to watch American Idol and reality television. You're out there changing reality for yourself.
Well, David Hellevarg, I want to thank you for being with us, author of Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness, and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. On Friday, we looked at gentrification and eviction in New York City. Well, today, we're going to look at eviction on the other side of the country, in Los Angeles, California. Farmers in South Central L.A. expect that within the week, they'll be forcibly barred from what is the largest urban farm in the United States. 350 area families have used the 14-acre farm to grow a multitude of crops since it was leased to the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank following the 1992 Rodney King riots. In 2003, the land was sold back to a real estate developer who now wants to turn it into commercial property. Since an eviction order last month, occupants have staged an encampment to resist removal from land they've tended for over a decade. The encampment has attracted celebrity supporters, including actor Daryl Hannah and Laura Dern, as well as singers Joan Baez and Ben Harper. This is environmental activist Julia Butterfly Hill speaking at the encampment last week.
I'm here to carry the message that this issue is getting out there, and every person who hears it, who cares about protection of the environment, who cares about human rights, every single person who I've talked to gets absolutely committed the minute they hear this story. It's so much more than just this farm. It seems to ignite in people a vision for what's possible for our world.
Activist Julia Butterfly Hill, and this is Daryl Hannah, also speaking from the encampment last week.
I was so moved by it and so impressed that the biggest urban farm in the nation is right here in the middle of South Central L.A., a place that I wouldn't have expected it in a million years, and it's such a beautiful surprise. And so I just want to do everything in my power to help support these farmers.
Both Daryl Hannah and Julia Butterfly Hill were speaking from a tree where they camped out in support of the continued resistance of the farmers to the eviction order. Joining us on the phone from the farm encampment is Teza Zomack. He's the elected representative of the South Central Farmers. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us what is happening now, and also describe this area for people who know nothing about the struggle that's going on in South Central.
Well, this is one of the most industrialized areas in L.A. It's basically, full of warehouses. And, a lot of the warehouses around the vicinity are all empty and, with lease signs, with nobody using them. And this was a project, obviously, that was created out of the 1992 uprisings that you know, where the Mayor Bradley mitigated some of the land to the community so they could even out some of the disequities in the community. And that's basically been the basis of a project that the community came up to help themselves, a way of people using a common resource to feed themselves and to, you know, build community around them.
We're talking to Tezo Zomack, elected representative of the South Central Farmers. Can you talk about how what your struggle relates to the whole immigrant rights struggle?
Well, in the issue for us, it's basically about the Mesoamerican diaspora, you know, a movement of people on this continent for thousands of years. So within this vicinity of, you know, where people are talking about immigrant rights, I think that the issue is, you know, well connected to the way that the U.S. policies with farmers around the world, that, you know, as you push on them, there is a pull for them to move to where resources are available, or places where they can't, you know, they have to move from places where they can no longer have a sustainable environment, and so therefore they're pushed to places where, you know, like South L.A., where they can, you know, try to make a living.
So explain who the forces are now that are taking the land, that are forcing you off, and what is the timetable, and what is the Los Angeles leadership, political leadership, doing about this?
The issue has always been about, you know, related to the situation of families being, you know, right now we're being forced to be removed by a situation that was created by the city of L.A. And that, you know, we've always said that, you know, the situation was a simple mistake that the city has made, but because they have failed to acknowledge it, the effort to try to cover it up has become much more complicated, and, you know, even to the point where now where we are, you know, in an encampment to try to make a statement about, you know, a backroom deal that was made so a developer could get a piece of land for basically for free almost. And so not right now, since they've, you know, we've used the court for the last 3 years to prevent it, and, you know, we've been, you know, it's been manipulated against us. And now we've, you know, stand at a point where, you know, we had our negotiations with the sheriff's department that basically gave us their terms of engagement. And, you know, basically we're waiting to be evicted. I mean, I was expecting for us to be gone on Friday. We survived this weekend. This morning, I'm not hearing much activity out here. And my feeling is that, you know, this is a political issue. And, you know, and they're waiting for Tuesday when the elections will be over. And I don't see ourselves being there beyond Tuesday with the, you know, with the threat of the sheriff's department and, you know, the amount of intensity of helicopters and surveillance that we're being approached with.
What effect has the celebrity support had on the movement? And do you think you will be able to, in any way, stop the eviction? You're also now getting international media attention.
Well, one of the strategies that we played out was that, you know, it was very easy to bury us in South Central, but that we needed a strategy to make us known beyond just South Central. And that's really what the celebrity situation has done for us, is it allow us to reach out to not only the, you know, the state, the nation, but, you know, again, international, to bring a spotlight on this issue and to create a situation where the liability for politicians to execute this situation carries with it a very high political price. And, you know, and also it brings up the issue about setting a precedent, meaning that, you know, if the eviction does happen, you know, the city of L.A. will set a precedent that basically says it is criminal to try to feed yourself. That's one of the very important issues that we brought forward. And additionally, one of the byproducts of this situation has been a historic moment, I believe, which is well, we have two diametrically opposed movements, the mainstream environmentalism and the environmental justice movements, coming together around one common issue and deciding that there is common ground, and then struggling together to basically preserve an oasis that has served the community for 14 years.
Finally, what are your plans if they move in to evict you? What will you do?
Well, as I've said to everybody, we will use all of our constitutional and civil rights to take a principled stand to basically demonstrate our commitment to a livable city.
And how many of you are there?
There's it keeps changing every day, and we keep growing by day. Every day we're on the land, we get more and more people. And, you know, just last night we had a concert with Tom Morello and Serge from the System Down, and we had, you know, over 500 people. And, you know, this morning I haven't gotten up to count how many people are on the encampment. So, I mean, it's quite a bit of people still here.
Tessa Zomack, I want to thank you for being with us. The website is SaveSouthCentralFarmers.com, and we will link to it at democracynow.org. Tessa Zomack is elected representative of the South Central Farmers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Salma Yacoob will join us, a leader of the British anti-war movement and the first hijab-wearing Birmingham City Council member. Stay with us.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulfstream waters, I tell you, this land was made for you.
This land is your land. Sharon Jones here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Violence raged across Iraq this weekend, with as many as 80 people killed Sunday alone. In Baghdad, officials discovered 22 bodies that had been burned, blindfolded, handcuffed, and thrown into a river. In a small town north of the capital, mass gunmen assassinated 24 people, mostly teenage students, in broad daylight. In Basra, a suicide car bomber killed 32 people and wounded 77. Monday, gunmen in police uniforms abducted up to 50 employees of various Baghdad transportation companies. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times is reporting new Iraqi government documents show that more Baghdad residents died in shootings, stabbings, and other violence in May than in any other month since the March 2003 invasion. The news coming a day after Iraqi political leaders failed to reach agreement on the two most important cabinet posts, further delaying the formation of a new government. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki planned to put candidates for the defense and interior ministries before the Iraqi parliament, but he ran into intense resistance from members of his own Shia party over the choice for defense minister. Well, this weekend in New York, the group Independent Viewpoints sponsored a forum called A Dialogue on Shias, Sunnis, and Politics in Iraq. The event featured MIT professor Noam Chomsky and a panel of Shias and Sunnis to talk about the situation there. We are joined now by one of those who participated in the panel. Her name is Salma Yacoob, and she flew in from Britain, from Birmingham. She heads the Birmingham Stop the War Coalition and is founder and vice chair of RESPECT, the Unity Coalition in England. This year, last month, actually, she won a seat on the city council in Birmingham and became the first elected hijab-wearing councillor in the city. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Your response to the latest in Iraq?
Well, it's almost predictable now. With this whole invasion, what's happened is that sectarian violence is actually being fostered. The propaganda line is that, oh, these people are sectarian, the Sunnis and Shias, and we need the army to now stay to keep these people apart or to bring about peace between them. And the reality is it's the invasion which acted as a trigger to the sectarian violence, because when the occupiers went in, they fostered one group over another. And then we're seeing retaliations going on. And the latest controversy to do with the ministries is that what the people of Iraq want are people from all the different backgrounds to come together in these powerful positions. Whereas if one group is elevated over another, you really see sowing the seeds for discord for generations to come, and that must be avoided at all costs.
Are you Shia or Sunni, and does that distinction have relevance in your life?
It really has no distinction in my life. My husband's father was Shia. I myself, actually, I don't even classify myself as a Sunni. You know, I just say I'm a Muslim. And again, these kind of questions almost become a distraction from what is really going on and the responsibility of British and American troops in the violence in Iraq today.
I wanted to talk about dissent and what it means for you to be a Muslim woman leader of an anti-war organization in Birmingham, in Britain, which certainly is an area that has come under intense scrutiny by the government with the Guantanamo detainees, Mozambique, and others who've recently returned, having been in prison for years in Guantanamo. Tell us about Birmingham.
Well, Birmingham is a multicultural, vibrant city. Since 9/11, the atmosphere definitely changed. British Muslims were being considered the fifth column within within Britain. The actions of a few individuals tainted all of us as a community. We were all on defensive. We were all having to constantly say how we condemned the attacks, which we, of course, we do. At the same time, though, it's as if we had personal responsibility in that. We have to divorce ourselves from it. We have to say we are not terrorists. We do not support terrorism, because Islam and Muslims as a whole have been tarnished with these terrorist attacks in a way that other communities don't get tarnished when individuals from those communities carry out atrocities in the same manner.
In Birmingham, how does the Muslim community, does it reflect divisions in the Sunni and along the Sunni-Shia divide, if there is one?
Well, 90% of Muslims would kind of come under what might be called Sunnis, and 10% Shias. That's just a historical fact. But in Birmingham, the issue isn't about Sunnis or Shias. It's about confidence. Since 9/11, many, many Muslims have lost confidence, lost a sense of belonging, because we're constantly asked, are you British or are you Muslim, as if the two things are mutually exclusive. It's as ridiculous as saying, well, are you a woman or are you Muslim? You know, it's possible to be both, actually. And what's happened is that especially the older generation feel that it's not our place to express any dissent. Whilst we don't like what's happening in our name, because we are British citizens, maybe we're not the kind of people who can speak up now, because we'll be accused of being disloyal. And people like myself have been part of the struggle to challenge that and say, when we speak up for the Iraqi people or for the Afghanistan people or for our soldiers who have been sent to Iraq on a lie, we're not being disloyal to our country. We are being loyal, committed citizens, saying what's good for our country as well as what's good for people around the world. And I think that's a really important concept to hold on to. And actually, it's not as easy as it might sound. The irony being, we talk a lot about democracy in the Middle East, but democracy in Western countries, in Britain, and I imagine in America too, is actually being tarnished and really eroded away with the actions of our governments.
I wanted to talk to you about Mozambique, the British citizen who was imprisoned for more than 3 years without charge by the United States, both at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and at Guantanamo in Cuba. In March, he spoke at an event in London to mark the publication of his book there, called Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back. The public conversation was held at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in central London. And Democracy Now! Is there to record it. Mozambique talked about his imprisonment.
It was probably one of the hardest periods of the whole of the incarceration. One particular month in May, I was subjected to some extremely harsh interrogation techniques, which included being or having my hands tied behind my back to my legs, like an animal, as they call in America, hog-tied, with a hood placed over my head, so I was in a suffocating position, kicked and beaten and sworn at and spat at, left to rot in this position for hours and hours on end, and taken again into interrogation. And this lasted over a period over a month. That wasn't the worst of it, of course. The worst of it, for me, was the psychological part, because all of this time I had no communication with my family at all. I didn't know what happened to my wife and my children. For all I knew, you know, they could have done terrible things to them. And that was the biggest fear.
Mozambique, speaking just a month ago in Britain. Salma Yacoub, head of the Birmingham Anti-War Coalition, you knew Mozam, you knew his family before the detention, certainly through it and after. Talk about the effect of his imprisonment.
Well, when he was imprisoned, it did send the whole community in this spiral of fear. So whilst many people are upset and concerned, they were more scared to speak out. It was only when we organized the big demonstrations, linked it to the anti-war argument as well, that people started to have the confidence to even speak his name. I mean, this is, it's hard to explain that in a Western democratic country where there'd be such fear. We're used to seeing the huge demonstrations, but actually we started with very small ones, and we had to build that confidence within our own community as well. And ironically, it was because the Muslims saw so many non-Muslims coming out side by side with them on this issue, that they too began to have the confidence. And it's a terrible story. It shows that anybody can be picked up, can be taken to Guantanamo Bay. You don't even know what you're being charged with, and left to rot. And I think it was only because of the huge pressure that came about through the demonstrations that even Tony Blair was forced to have to bring him back.
And what happened to Mozam's family during that time?
Well, they're very, very isolated. Nobody knew what was going on. The fact is, Mozam himself has never been told what exactly he's been charged with. So just the unknown, and all we hear about and all we knew about Guantanamo was that there was no real trial system. There's no way for anybody to say what they did or didn't do. There's no way to prove your innocence. And to this day, there are hundreds of men still left to rot there. Mozam is actually one of the few that's managed to come back, and actually it shows the power of a people power, really, protest, and that when people show they care, that that person then becomes somebody important to the administration. It's out of embarrassment, not out of principle, that in the end the British government was forced to bring him back.
Salma Yacoub, you ran for the British Parliament, or what do you say, stood for it?
Yeah.
You lost that.
Yes, it was very close, so I lost by, we just needed 1,600 more votes from the rival, but it was unprecedented that to run for the first time and really dent them in a very, very safe Labour constituency. And for me, it was saying, well, can we do this? For me, it was more important to get out there, put forward an alternative political programme. We have no real political debate or discussion left. We'd marched, we'd been ignored, and for me, it showed the democratic deficit in our own House of Parliament that the majority of MPs voted for the war, when the majority of people in Britain were against it even prior to it. It was a bit different from America. In Britain, it was very clear that the majority of people did not agree that the war should have even
begun. How many people came out for your protests?
2 million people, and that's the largest in 2,000 years of British history. It was absolutely phenomenal. And when that happened, and then we had elections that same year, I remember going to the ballot booth thinking, who do I vote for when all of the mainstream parties have colluded with this? You know, and I was getting fed up with having to vote for the least worst. I thought, well, why can't we vote for a party that we actually believe in? And so it sounded crazy, but I thought we should have a new national party built on a consensus in the anti-war movement. A whole diverse range of people had come together on a single issue. And I was wondering, can this diversity be reflected in other issues as well? And I actually found yes, on pensions, on university fees, we're against them, on privatisation. And all these issues, a lot of people actually agree on a common platform. And that's where Respect was born.
George Galloway, who was Labour thrown out, also yes. ran on the Respect Party ticket and won.
Yes, he won. So we have an MP, we have a Member of Parliament, and we have 20 councillors. And that's incredible, given that we're only 2 years old. So it shows there's a real desire for change, there's a real desire for real political discussion in our country.
So while you lost that seat, you did win the seat for City Council. What are you doing in the City Council? How significant is that? Also that you're the first hijab-wearing member of the Birmingham City Council.
Of course, there's an element of pride just from the community point of view. But to be honest, it's almost irrelevant as well. I'm not running as a Muslim candidate. I'm running as a Respect candidate, which is a platform to do with anti-privatisation on the domestic front and an ethical and fair foreign policy on the international front. And I think it's important that people see somebody who represents their views in a real way. And I think that's what's been exciting about Respect. I was actually offered a platform with other mainstream parties, and if I had wanted to be an MP, you know, through a mainstream party, I could have won it.
You mean like through Labour?
Yeah, well, or through the Liberal Democrats. And, you know, I was offered by them all, you know, to come and join them. But for me, their policies did not reflect what I believe in. I think the principle's more important. And I thought it's a harder path. But if the symbolism of a hijab-wearing Muslim woman was not enough for me, it was about the policies that we are going to be standing up for. And that's why I'm proud to be a Respect councillor.
Was your family concerned about you putting yourself out there like this?
Very much so. I'm a mom myself. I have three young children, and my parents live next door to me. And I tell you, I mean, my family were saying, don't do this. I have received death threats. You know, we have put ourselves on the line literally with the things that we do. But I think when you look at what's happening in the world and you look at, in a way, we are the most powerful citizens living in Western democracies, we have a responsibility with that, and we have to have courage at this time, and we have to have compassion, and we have to have consistency, because sometimes we get emotional and we get upset at what we're seeing on TV and we get down. But I think just as people like Bush and Blair are very consistent and dedicated in their cause, we have to be even more so in our cause.
And what about, Salma, you being a woman in the Muslim community who is speaking out?
Well, it, again, was something quite new. There aren't many precedents for it. I'm fighting kind of two battles. There's one of challenging the stereotypes that people have about Muslim women, that we're all oppressed and quiet and, you know, we haven't got anything to say for ourselves and no contribution to make to society. At the same time, and as a Muslim woman, I can sit here and say, well, Islam gives me, I feel empowered by it. I feel very, you know, I'm an equal to a man. You know, this is not in our faith, the kind of cultural baggage that many Muslim communities have been ladled with. And so at the same time, I was fighting traditional conservative viewpoints from within the community who were not used to seeing Muslim women stand up in public and be very vocal and strong in what they had to say.
And the whole issue of separation of church and state, or mosque and state, or synagogue and state.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm coming from an ethical, moral framework with a passion for my political standpoints. And yes, I wear a hijab, but this is my spiritual, personal choice. So I don't think the issue of the mosque and the state comes into this. I'm not advocating Sharia law in Britain or in America. So I think we have to be very careful to distinguish between these things. I am here saying that we have more in common, you know, whether as Muslims or non-Muslims, with each other in our quest for justice and peace and equality than any differences. And my line isn't, are you Muslim or not, or are you man or a woman, or are you black or white? It's, are you on the side of the oppressed or the oppressor? And if you're on the side of the oppressed, whatever your community, I'm on your side. And if you're on the side of the oppressor, whatever your background, Muslim, man, whatever, I'm going to be against you.
Salma Yacoub, I want to thank you for being with us. Head of the Birmingham Stop the War Coalition, founder and vice chair of RESPECT, the Unity Coalition in Britain, won a seat on the Birmingham City Council. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Stranberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, and Samantha Chambly. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, I'll be at the 92nd Street Y in New York, interviewing Helen Thomas. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.